In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Elections matter. How many times have we heard that? Elections matter because the people we elect are supposed to follow the Constitution, which guarantees the government will not infringe on our rights. Elections matter because some politicians don't understand the concept of God-given rights and the government's responsibility to defend those rights. Just look at COVID and how many rights got trampled because the wrong people got elected. But it's more than that. Elections matter because literally trillions of dollars are at stake. Elections matter because who gets elected decides how to spend those trillions of dollars. Elections matter because elected officials appoint people to oversee all of that spending. And as we've seen all too often when Democrats get in charge, Democrats make sure billions of dollars go to Democrat organizations and their allies. Generally speaking, that's different than Republicans. As evidence, just look at the spending on green energy. In just two bills passed by Democrats, the Inflation Reduction Act, which did not reduce inflation, and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which did not build infrastructure or create jobs, but in just those two bills, well north of $1 trillion was dedicated to green energy, to Democrat groups, to climate justice, to DEI, and a bunch of other far-left ideological groups and organizations. All just happened to be aligned with Democrats. When's the last time Republicans created a bill to funnel even just $1 billion to the National Rifle Association, or give just $500 million to a pro-life organization? It doesn't happen. That's why elections matter. And that means the process of elections matter, how they are conducted, and whether you can trust the outcomes. This show is not about election fraud, it's about the conditions that could lead to fraud. Because if election fraud happens, it happens because of dirty voter rolls. If election fraud happens, it happens because there are not safeguards to make sure people who should not be voting do not vote. And Oregon has both of those two elements. Extremely dirty voter rolls, and because we have entirely vote by mail, there are no safeguards, no chain of custody, to make sure that people who should not be voting do not vote. And by the way, a Democrat, Jimmy Carter, said that exact same thing. Vote by mail cannot be trusted because you have no idea who actually filled out that ballot. We should be able to trust the people who get elected, which means we should be able to trust our elections to get them elected. If you can't trust how they got elected, then you cannot trust the people who do get elected. Well, we have just jumped over a major hurdle toward restoring trust in our elections here in Oregon. Judicial Watch sued Oregon to force it to clean up the dirtiest in the nation voter rolls. And just last week, the judge finally ruled and ruled that the plaintiffs did have standing, and the case will now proceed. In the second half of the show, we will talk about how elections matter and the changes that can happen, the good changes, when elections actually work. For now, I'd like to welcome back Eric Lee. He is a senior attorney with Judicial Watch who serves on their election integrity team. Eric, it is great to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me, Mark. Glad to be here.
I've really been looking forward to this because common sense Oregonians finally got a win here, at least on standing, which had to happen. Otherwise, the lawsuit to clean up the voter rolls could not proceed. And so the judge ruled in your case that the state of Oregon's amended motion to dismiss is granted in part and denied in part. Count one is dismissed for lack of standing as to all plaintiffs except the Constitution Party of Oregon, which has adequately pled organizational standing. And then count two is dismissed for failure to give adequate notice. So it's a partial win with only one of the four plaintiffs granted standing, which is what you and I had actually predicted, that if nothing else, the Constitution Party would get standing. Can you break it down for our audience why they got standing and the others didn't?
Sure. So the Constitution Party was one of four plaintiffs that had brought this suit against the state of Oregon and the Secretary of State, alleging that they had not abided by their procedures to clean the voter list and made reasonable efforts in that regard in violation of the MVRA. And one of the parties was the Constitution Party of Oregon, which is a minor political party in the state. And the other plaintiffs were Judicial Watch, of course, which is an organization in Washington, D.C. that does list maintenance and voter roll cleanup and throughout the country. And then we had two registered voters, one from the Republican Party and one from the Constitution Party, that brought these claims. And the claims involved injuries, and the injuries that we asserted were both based on the individual and on the organization. And the individual injuries were lack of confidence in the integrity of elections, which undermined their ability to participate in the democratic process. And that was with respect to the individual voters' injuries. And the organizational injuries were with respect to failure to remove ineligible voters actually impairs the core function of the Constitution Party in order to monitoring their registered voters in the state, both active and inactive, in order to maintain minor political party in the state, because you have to have a certain number of registered voters in your party in order to maintain minor political party status. And that organizational injury with respect to the Constitution Party, the court found was sufficient to confer something called Article 3 standing, which is an injury in fact that's related to the cause of action and the defendant's conduct. And the defendant's conduct here, or lack thereof, would, as we allege, is the failure to update and keep track of eligible and ineligible registrations on the Oregon's official list of eligible voters.
Does it matter in any way that only the Constitution Party got standing, or does that not basically change anything?
So the claims still proceed. There's a rule that the Supreme Court has outlined, and the Ninth Circuit has as well, called the Rule of One. And it's just a general rule. It doesn't mean that the courts have to always follow it. And that basically says that if one party has standing, then the court does not need to go into the standing of the other parties. Now, the court did so in this case, and that's fine. That's the court's prerogative. But just because you have one party that has Article 3 standing, that doesn't, that means the claims can still go forward. So even if we don't have Judicial Watch and the two registered voters, we still have the Constitution Party of Oregon. And so those claims can proceed.
Okay. So the hearing was June 18th and the ruling was issued August 5th. That's 49 days, 7 weeks. He thought 2 weeks. And any ideas as to why it took so long? I mean, did you get any indications why it took so long?
I'm not sure. I think that actually 49 days is fairly quick in terms of what I've experienced in other cases, because sometimes they can take months, up to 6 months, I think, in some cases that we haven't received a decision. And I'll just note that the Bost decision that's going up before the Supreme Court, we had a hearing at the district court in that case in December of 2023, and we didn't get a decision from the district court until July of 2024. And so that just shows you how long it can take. So it depends on the court's docket, how many cases they have. Sometimes they can get a criminal case and a long trial that results from that criminal case. And so that can bog down the court's docket. So there can be many other factors that play into the length of time it takes. Now, the 49 days is actually on the quicker end. So that's very,
I'm sorry. A couple of weeks before you guys got your ruling in Oregon's case, there were a pair of rulings in California, and I think the other one was Illinois, that also allowed voter roll cleanup cases standing. And
that's,
I was
right,
kind of wondering if the judge had been sort of waiting to see how those rulings came out before he made his own. Is that possible, or am I just reading too much into it?
It's possible. I know I'm not exactly sure that the Judge McShane in the Oregon case did not cite either of the California the Illinois case, but both California and Illinois came out the week before. And so the last week of July, I think it was a Tuesday and then the Wednesday. And so we had California on Tuesday, Illinois on Wednesday in July. And we submitted on Monday, the 4th, August 4th, to the district court, a statement of supplemental authority. I did just notifying the court that these decisions had came down in California and Illinois, and this is the reasoning, and they were decisions in our favor.
Yeah, and then the very next day, his ruling comes out. So you know, maybe it's circumstantial, maybe it's just coincidence, but it is kind of interesting. Okay, let's take a break here. Now that standing has been granted, there are a lot of what nows and what ifs. We'll talk about those coming up, including something I really want to hear more about. Discovery. That's next with Eric Lee, senior attorney on Judicial Watch's Election Integrity Team. And welcome back. We're talking with Eric Lee. He's a senior attorney with Judicial Watch and serves on their election integrity team. Judicial Watch sued the state of Oregon on behalf of the Constitution Party and two individual voters to force Oregon to clean up their voter rolls. And last week, the judge granted standing to the Constitution Party. And so now the lawsuit can proceed. So besides discovery, which we'll talk about in a second here, can you outline what are the basic next steps and how this all proceeds now that standing has been granted?
Sure. So after the decision under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, Rule 12A4, the defendant must file a responsive pleading within 14 days of the decision. And that was 14 days from last Tuesday. August 5th is August 19th. And so that's the deadline that the defendants have to file something called an answer, which is a responsive pleading to our complaint, which will outline the allegations that we made in our complaint, admit, deny, or lack some sufficient information to respond to them. And then, based on Judge McShane's website and the local rules of the District of Oregon, and I just want to just note that I'm not an Oregon attorney. I'm not licensed in Oregon. Steve Jonkis, who's our local counsel, he's the Oregon attorney. I'm admitted in this case under a rule called pro hoc vice for limited admission. But I know the federal rules. I read the Oregon District Court local rules. And within a certain period of time after the defendants file an answer on the 19th, Judge McShane will issue something called a Rule 16B. It's Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 16B scheduling conference. And basically, what the scheduling conference does is it'll outline the schedule for the proceedings after, during discovery, timeline for dispositive motions on summary judgment, expert disclosures, and trial date. And so after that Rule 16B conference is scheduled, the parties will have a certain amount of time, not later than 2 weeks before the Rule 16B conference, to file something called a Rule 26F conference report. And that's a conference report that you file with the court, and it basically outlines the procedures that both parties discussed regarding discovery, dispositive motions, and how long they anticipate trial would last, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's basically where we are now.
So basically, you kind of develop sort of an overview. Okay, here's what we're kind of agreeing to and the schedules and that sort of thing. So,
right.
Okay, so now that I understand that, the last time that we talked, we briefly touched on the discovery phase, and you didn't really want to get into it too much. But now that the case has been granted standing, what is that process like? And can you give us some hints in terms of the types of things that you're going to be asking for?
Well, I can't give hints yet of the types of things we'll be asking for. I think that the types of information that we would want to develop further are in allegations in our complaint regarding the merits. And those are basically the inactive registrations. They did not report any inactive registrations. There were some jurisdictions that reported removals of zero within a certain period of time to the EAC.
Well, that's because nobody moves out of Oregon.
Well, we allege that there were 14.5% based on the census statistics that have moved, that have changed address out of Oregon during this time. And large counties in Oregon have not removed any registrations. At least they admitted they haven't removed any registrations under this procedure of the NVRA, which governs change of address removals.
Right. Yeah. Well, they should be removing those because we've had a whole bunch of people move out of Oregon. So let me ask it this way. Are there any things off limits? I mean, are you limited solely to voter registration issues, or can you look into broader issues? For example, how people who are registered but should not be are getting ballots that they should not be getting, and whether such ballots are in fact being returned.
If it's relevant to our claims, and it's discoverable, it's relevant to in discovery. And so if it's relevant to failure to remove ineligible registrations, then it's subject to discovery either through requests for production of documents, interrogatories, depositions of key officials, usually not the Secretary of State under a doctrine that the Supreme Court has laid out, unless they have personal knowledge. But if anyone that has personal knowledge in the Secretary of State's office has list maintenance capabilities, and they would know information that would bear on the allegations of the complaint, then that's subject to discovery. So if a registrant is getting mail ballots and they're not eligible, and that's evidence of a violation of the NVRA, failure to remove ineligible registrations.
When you're at this stage in things, because you mentioned people within the election system themselves, is this when whistleblowers tend to emerge?
Yeah, I have seen I've seen that in the past. I can't disclose it, obviously, because of whistleblower protections.
Sure.
But I have seen that in the past, and if a witness has personal knowledge of the facts in the complaint or facts related to list maintenance, then they would be a witness that would have discoverable information.
So in other cases, has the process of discovery, and you know, I mean, cases in other states, obviously, has the process of discovery surprised you in any way that you found things or procedures that you just had no clue about?
Yes and no. I think that the our Los Angeles case was surprising, because in discovery we found out something that we did not know, and that was a settlement agreement that the state had entered into during the Clinton administration in the 90s that actually prevented them from using a particular procedure to send a notice to registrations and then remove that registration at the second federal election as required under the NVRA. Actually, they entered into a settlement agreement with the Clinton administration that said that they could not remove those registrations unless they had some type of evidence that they had removed beyond the failure to respond to the notice. Well, the Supreme Court has said that that's not needed because Congress said the only evidence you need for evidence of change of address is the failure to respond to a notice. That's what Congress said in the NVRA. So you don't need anything more than that. You just need failure to respond to a notice and then failure to vote for two federal consecutive elections, and then they must be removed. And
yeah. I'm glad you brought that up because that brings up a hypothetical I wanted to run by you. So let's go ahead and take a break there. Everyone stay with us. We'll continue with Eric Lee. He's a senior attorney with Judicial Watch on their election integrity team. They just had a big win in federal court when the judge acknowledged they have standing to proceed in their lawsuit to force Oregon to clean up its voter rolls. We always like good news, and there was some great news last week for election integrity when Judicial Watch, on behalf of its client, the Constitution Party, was given standing in its case to force Oregon to clean up its voter rolls, and that case can now proceed. And so I'd like to run a hypothetical past you because it kind of has to do with your previous answer there in terms of what's the process to remove people from the voter rolls, because Oregon, and the judge cited this in his ruling, the state of Oregon had kind of huffed and puffed in its argument why they should not have to clean up its voter rolls, that only active registered voters get ballots, so there's no possibility for election fraud by having ineligible voters in the rolls, so it's like basically no big deal. But here's the problem with that assertion. There is a process before a voter is moved from active to inactive. If they haven't voted in two federal elections, as you mentioned, they get sent a notice, but that's 4 years of someone staying on the rolls who shouldn't be. And it could be that someone at that address is sending back ballots, even if that person is there but doesn't want to vote or is no longer there at all. Somebody at that address is sending back those ballots. And so from the state's point of view, that person who isn't there is perceived as active because that person is allegedly sending back ballots. Or if a voter moves between elections, but the state doesn't know that voter moved, a ballot is still sent there, which means that somebody could cast that ballot fraudulently. So that was part of your lawsuit. You wanted to know things like the response rates of the required mailers sent out. How does that discovery look from what you guys are going to be digging into? And is that one of the things you'll be digging into, is that process?
Well, we don't know yet. We just have alleged that in a complaint. But you're right that the inactive voters, they stay on the registration list for two general federal elections without activity. And then they have to remove. But that 3 to 4 year period, they can then move back into active status if they contact the registrar. So then they get or the county clerk, then they get the ballot. And that was part of our injury with the Constitution Party, because if you're not keeping track of who is active and inactive and properly, like we alleged in the complaint, then it's hard to maintain your party status. And so that's the procedure of the NVRA, that 3 to 4 year period, that it's vital that you keep track of it as a state in order to make sure that you are keeping track of the voters, and you are not giving them ballots that they shouldn't be giving ballots, and you're timely removing them after the second federal election if they're not.
Well, I just think it's an overblown assertion that they couldn't possibly be voter fraud because only active voters get ballots. I think that's just absurd. So now that standing has been granted, if there's a way to screw things up and keep the voter rolls dirty, I suspect Oregon will find unique and creative ways to screw things up and then hand off what clever tricks they created to keep their voter rolls dirty. Oregon is, after all, the Wuhan lab of leftist policies. Experiment here first to enhance it and then export policies with gain of function to other states. So what are some ways that Oregon can try to thwart things? I mean, what has been the response of other states in this situation? Once granted standing, do they just sort of throw up their hands and say, fine, whatevs, and comply, or do they continue to resist?
Most states do agree to comply, and our most jurisdictions that we have sued. After we survive a motion to dismiss and we get into discovery, they then want to settle and say, okay, yes, we'll actually do what you want us to do. We'll start sending notices to registrations that are supposed to be sent notices. We'll track them. We'll remove them after the second federal election if they don't respond. And then we'll also give you yearly updates, data that shows that we are actually performing these tasks. And so we have received settlements across the country in this regard, and we do get periodic reporting from jurisdictions from New York City all the way to Los Angeles County in California and everywhere in between. The problem with California, though, is that in 2017 we sued Los Angeles County. They're one county, they're the biggest county, there's 10 million registrations in that county, but there are other counties in California that are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And so that we're back in California trying to enforce it for about two dozen other counties in California that are not doing this.
Well, you had mentioned yearly updates. Some election integrity watchdogs have alleged that what happens in Oregon is they will take people off and then right before the next election, they'll add them back in. As far as those yearly updates are concerned, is that just saying how many they've taken off to give you just, you know, basic numbers, you know, 5,000 or something, or did it actually show you the people that were removed?
Yeah, they sent us a spreadsheet of the names. Okay. And so we're able to get the spreadsheet of the names with the voter registration list, and we're able to cross-check those names with the list and make sure that they're not on. And we have those lists, so if we get them year one, and then we get another one year two, usually the settlement agreement, like Los Angeles County settlement agreement, now we're 5 years, 6 years in, we're getting updates every year. So we'll have those spreadsheets every year. And so we'll be able to go back and check to see if have there any of those ones that have been removed, are they back on, and what's the reason for them being back on.
So let's give some people some hope here. Talk to us about some other states where you have successfully cleaned up the voter rolls. What was the impact there? Like, for example, how many were removed from the rolls that should not have been there? And also, was there an impact in the next election?
Sure. So we received since 2018 or 2019, we removed over 5 million registrations from jurisdictions in New York, Pennsylvania, Colorado, North Carolina, California. I might be forgetting one or two, but we have data sets that show, and I think that our team, our media team's working on a interactive graph of all the states so people can check them online to show what we've done. And we've removed 5 million registrations that are ineligible under our NVRA.
And did you see any impact in the next election?
I'm not sure. I don't know how that works with electoral results. They're not, we don't target anything based on politics. Where
your goal is to make sure that the potential for cheating is certainly lessened, and we certainly applaud you for that. So, okay, we are up against the break here. Eric Lee, senior attorney with Judicial Watch on their election integrity team, congratulations on the standing, and good luck going forward. Love to have you back on soon to talk about it.
Perfect. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We just wrapped up with Eric Lee, a senior attorney on Judicial Watch's election integrity team, discussing their win in federal court. They were given standing in a lawsuit to force Oregon to clean up its voter rolls, and that case can now proceed. In the second half of this show, we're going to be focusing on how and why elections matter and the changes that can happen, good changes, when elections work because the potential for fraud is taken out of things. You can actually get some good results. And we saw that on the national level, and yes, election fraud does happen. We have cited this before, but an attorney in Michigan found over 120,000 fraudulent duplicate votes had been cast And that would have been enough to overturn Trump's victory there in Michigan, where the margin of victory was only about 80,000. That guy deserves a medal. I would like to welcome Chuck Weiss to the show. Chuck Weiss is a trained scientist, meteorologist, and we'd love to have him on because he's such a fearsome global warming debunker. Chuck has also become a bit of a political activist in his own right and has been involved in several election integrity lawsuits here in Oregon. Chuck, it is great to have you on.
Well, glad to be here, Mark.
Yeah, so you were in our virtual green room and got to hear Eric's segment, so I'd like to get your thoughts, given your experiences with unsuccessful lawsuits to bring some integrity back to Oregon. But let's start with just the win to get standing, because if I remember correctly, we didn't have you on the show, but we talk fairly frequently. It seems like you didn't have a lot of faith that Judicial Watch would actually get standing, given your own experiences with election lawsuits, an Obama-appointed judge, and West Coast courtrooms' general antipathy to election integrity lawsuits. So were you surprised by the ruling that they did, in fact, get standing?
Well, yes, I am pleasantly surprised, not 100% surprised, but pleasantly surprised, put it that way, just because of the way all the past rulings on this have gone. And as you know, when our lawsuits went through the courts that basically were born out of the Tim Sipple case, what we wanted to do ultimately in the end is stop vote by mail, because we were certain that if we were allowed to go forward, we would find more than enough evidence if we were allowed to look into the machines to where they would be culprit in or vulnerable to the same sorts of things we were concerned about in the lawsuit. But we never got to go that far, as you know, because the courts used the standing excuse to shut us down and said, no, nothing is going to happen. So we just had to turn around and go away. Well, in this case, it's the Constitution Party that was small enough, which is kind of ironic because it's small enough to where the accusations or the assertions made in this lawsuit got the judge's attention and made him believe that, yes, there could definitely be this party getting harmed by the fact that they're much smaller in number. And so if there was a misrepresentation or fraud or bad voting that was counted, it could basically rule completely against them and cause them to lose an election. So with the smaller numbers, that's how they got into this standing business, if my understanding of it is correct from Eric, and that was earlier on the show. So that is very good news, because at least it starts to open the door to look into the problems Oregon has with its voting system. But there's still a lot to uncover, and I'm hoping they'll be able to do it. The thing I didn't like was the judge still threw parts of the lawsuit out. The other parties that were involved, he basically said, nope, you're not going to be part of this. So he really narrowed it down to that party. And it should have included everybody. So that part I'm disappointed in. So we'll just have to see where we can work with the Constitution Party to see if the door can be opened that might lead to amendment to the lawsuit and further examination of the Oregon problems. But I think they go all the way up to the machine. It's not just the vote counting, because we were never given an opportunity. And as you know, Oregon fought us terribly. I mean, all the way to the nail, to keep us from getting a look at those machines. And we heard some outrageous claims about how they couldn't share any of that data with us in our lawsuit because of a claim of public harm, which was nonsense.
Well, it seems to me that if you're not allowed to look at a machine that governs and determines the outcomes of elections, then something is seriously wrong there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All we ever said in our lawsuit, and by the way, the evidence we presented to the court showed plenty of malfeasance, of all kinds of bad voter registrations, shenanigans that were being played on college campuses. There was a whole litany of items that we had that we put in the lawsuit to let the court take a look at, and they just didn't seem to care about any of it. But that's just the start of it. The machines were something that definitely need to be looked at too, which was our next step, because Tim Sipple's case was blocked from being able to do that as well. And that's one of the reasons why we picked up where he left off, hoping to get a favorable ruling, but it just never happened.
Yeah, and the Tim Sipple case was interesting as well, because this was a lawsuit where he had approached Washington County and said, hey, I'd like to take a look at the database. I think it was the DA there within Washington County said, sure, that's public information. Of course you can look at it. And he was given the database, but then the Secretary of State jumped in and sued him to block him from looking that. It's a database. It ought to be public information. If you're saying that that is proprietary information, then you are screwing around with that database somehow. where you're waiting things or something along those lines, because otherwise it should be a list of names, addresses, and the times and elections in which they voted. Anything beyond that, it's just data that should absolutely be open to public scrutiny.
Yeah, and the databases that we were asking the court to give us clearance to look at were owned by the county. Mm-hmm. They were proprietary information that was owned by the county in contract with the vote tabulation company. So from our point of view and from our lawyer's point of view, the county had every right to do whatever they wanted with that database. They didn't have to hide it, and suddenly they switched gears and said, well, we can't share it with you, when it's very clear that the contract said you own everything in that database and everything that's being used by the machines in the contract you had with Clear Ballot, which I think was the name of the company that counts the ballots. But nonetheless, they changed gears on that and said, "Nah, it's proprietary. We can't let the public see it for fear that it will increase the risk of voter fraud," which is nonsense. Yeah. That to me just it made no sense at all.
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, I'm hoping. I actually asked Eric about that off air. I'm hoping that is one of the things that they can dig into, because as part of their discovery, I would think they'd be able to say, hey, let's take a look at some of these voting databases that you're dealing with, especially in terms of how it deals with these people that should not be getting ballots at all because they shouldn't be on the voter rolls. So who knows? We will have to see where that goes. Let's go ahead and take a break here. Everyone stay with us. We'll continue this discussion with Chuck Weiss after this. Back. We're continuing with Chuck Weiss. He's a trained scientist, meteorologist, and we'd love to have him on because he's such a fearsome global warming debunker. Sorry about that, Chuck. Jeepers, what an insult. And also, he has been involved in several election integrity lawsuits here in Oregon, and coming off the fresh win here by Judicial Watch to get standing, and now that lawsuit can proceed to force Oregon to clean up its voter rolls. And I wanted to ask you about another lawsuit that Judicial Watch has going, because it will directly impact Oregon as well. And this is something that just happened, that the Supreme Court of the United States has scheduled oral arguments for October 8th, 2025, to vindicate Judicial Watch's and their clients' standing to challenge an Illinois law that extends Election Day for 14 days beyond the established date by federal law. And, this happens in Oregon and other blue states. Let's get an initial tally on Election Day to see how far behind we are, and then we'll get Democrat organizations out there to dredge up some more Democrat votes in close races. And so I'm hoping that this goes forward, because it's ridiculous that we just keep extending this deadline for when you can get your votes in. And like I said, it happens right here in Oregon.
Yeah, they passed some bills, in the Oregon legislature within the last 2 years that basically mm-hmm. said that they'll count ballots received with a postmark on them that if it's no longer than, I think it was, 3 days past the, as long as it's...
it had to be postmarked. Yeah, it had to be postmarked by Election Day.
But if it's received up to like 3 days, I think it can be 3 days late. I forgot the exact number, but it's several days past the Election Day.
Yeah, I think they've extended that now to 14.
Yeah, and they say, well, we'll still count these, as long as they're postmarked on Election Day. Well, it's just what you said, Mark. I mean, this isn't even caring about how they're hiding things anymore. They're just making it very clear that the intention is to make sure they can sway elections with bad votes. And this is why the lawsuits came forward over, election integrity with Judicial Watch and things we'd done in the past. Because by extending the time in which they can count ballots, it's just like you said, they can run a tab all the way up to Election Day. And if they don't like the results, who knows where the extra ballots are actually coming from that could make a difference in an election. And we saw that way back in the 2010 election for the governor's race. Mm-hmm. Now, here in Oregon, where
Chris Dedling,
the Republican candidate, was way ahead all the way through election night, and then the next day, suddenly John Kitzhaber pulls ahead with a bunch of extra ballots that showed up from Multnomah County.
Yeah.
And that just, whether it's legitimate or not, it raises the suspicion of one county getting all these extra ballots for one candidate.
Yeah, that just happened to be enough to go overcome that margin of victory. That was the other thing that was suspicious. I can understand if they found like 500 votes or something down there, but to find 40,000 some votes, if I remember right, I mean, that was just ridiculous.
Well, I think it was 20-some thousand, but nonetheless, I mean, you just don't get, and it was all for Mr. Kitzhaber.
Yeah.
I mean, all those votes came in for Mr. Kitzhaber. They were all out of Multnomah County, and the excuse was, well, gee, we didn't know where this just suddenly shows up. It was a bag of votes or several bags of votes that someone just overlooked these, and they should have been put in the processor and the tabulator, so they were counted yesterday or the day before, and we don't know why that didn't happen, but now we got to get them in there because they're legit.
Yeah.
And that was their
I think if memory serves, there's actually closer to 2 million votes they found.
Yeah.
would it surprise anyone? I mean, really. So,
well, this is the reason why we want success in these lawsuits, because it's not a coincidence, Mark, I'm sure you would agree with me, that ever since we went to vote by mail in the state of Oregon, we have not elected a Republican governor. And that's not a coincidence.
Yeah, and I think that
you can't convince me.
I think even all statewide races, I think we've only had the one win, and that was Richardson for Secretary of State. I could be wrong on that, but I mean, it's a rather odd coincidence that suddenly we have vote by mail and no more Republican candidates ever win. So we should probably move on, because we want to talk about how good elections that you can actually trust do have consequences. And of course, that's kind of the theme for today, is that elections matter. Elections have consequences. And when you take the fraud out, like what happened there in Michigan, you can get good results. And now what we're seeing is Trump getting into office, and he's making some tremendous strides in things, especially squashing green energy, which, of course, is something that you're very involved in, getting rid of the whole nonsense of climate change. And I honestly think that somebody in Trump's inner circle finally got to him and said, hey, if you want to stop the Democrats, you have got to cut off their public funding, because they are getting hundreds of billions of dollars from us, from the taxpayers, every year. We are literally funding our own demise every time we vote through some of this green energy.
Yes. A good example of that, and one thing that still very much concerns me, I mean, it's great that President Trump got back into office, because at the federal level, he can do a lot to put plugs in all of this money stream that's going out to the climate change nonsense. But one thing that concerned me, and I don't know if you remember it, was last spring. This is just after Trump was getting his cabinet put into place and things were getting going. Senator Kennedy grilled somebody from the Department of Energy in a hearing, and he got out of this guy that they had shoveled, and this is just before Joe Biden left the White House. So there came a time, this convinces me, there came a time before the election that these people must have known, it's not looking good for Kamala Harris. She's probably going to lose. What do we do to protect our interest if President Trump gets back into the White House? Well, these people in the Department of Energy under Joe Biden shoveled $93 billion. I'm not talking millions. They shoveled $93 billion out of the Department of Energy to these various climate change things that I think they were interested in protecting. And since all that happened, and since that hearing, I haven't heard anything as to what happened to tracing the money or whether they could claw it back.
I think they managed to claw back a lot of that. And I think the phrase they actually used was, because there was part of it was an undercover sting by Project Veritas, O'Keefe anyway, that they were throwing gold bars off the Titanic. And so I believe that they are able to claw back a bunch of that. And even if some of the funding for green energy, they weren't able to stop all of it because, you know, they were past a certain point that, of development or whatever. So they weren't able to cut back all of it, but they have certainly managed to cut off literally tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars so far from just green energy in this funding cycle. And I think that's exciting. So let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll wrap things up with Chuck Weiss after this. And welcome back. We've been talking about election integrity today. We're wrapping things up with Chuck Weiss, a trained scientist, meteorologist, and political activist who has been part of several election integrity lawsuits here in Oregon. Elections matter because when you get good people in charge, you tend to get good results. Hundreds of billions of dollars went to the far left under Joe Biden via green energy and climate change cash. But thanks to the 2024 election where fraud was prevented, a lot of that funding has been or is being cut off. And it's starting with cutting off green subsidies and canceling multi-billion dollar wind and solar projects. Here in Oregon, an offshore wind project was canceled altogether. So Chuck, are you hearing anything in your circles about maybe just a little panic starting to set in among the green energy industries or global warmers?
No, I haven't heard any panic at the state level here in Oregon. Sometimes, there'll be words leaking out about that. But one of the things that concern me, even if they've clawed back a significant number of the $93 billion that Biden tried to shovel out the door before he left office, I think the strategy now, if a lot of that had to go back, may very well be to try to keep the climate change fraud and the climate change funding alive through state government. And as you know, there's been a furious amount of fighting going on in Salem to get the transportation package passed. And a lot of that, that was the biggest tax hike in Oregon history. And there's no question in my mind. Yeah, it would have been if she would have gotten it through. And there's no question in my mind that part of the reason why they wanted so much money was because they knew the federal money was getting shut off because of President Trump.
Yep.
And so they're trying to make up for that. And so I don't think that anything has died yet here in Oregon because it's so deeply entrenched, the green energy stuff. And you've got a group of politicians in Salem that are obsessed with this, who will not look at facts, who will not be willing to sit down and realize that what they're proposing to do will have no effect on atmospheric CO2, the climate or weather or anything. It's all a big ruse, and they continue to lie about it. And that's what's so disheartening here in the state of Oregon, because the lies continue to come out of academia about this, and it's very disheartening. And in some sense, as I was telling you before we started the show today, there are even some of these people now in academia that are distancing themselves from these crazy climate policies that the state legislature keeps putting out and has enacted through executive orders, such as the Climate Protection Program. They're distancing themselves from this, saying, we don't get involved in public policy making. We're just climate scientists doing our own little thing. Well, that's ridiculous, mm-hmm. because they're right in the middle of it. They're the ones that have the ultimate authority and power because of where they stand in the eyes of the Democrat Party, to where all they would have to do is say, look, guys, as much as we'd like to be able to get CO2 levels down, we don't have anything that's really working, and the stuff you're doing now, everything now in the Climate Protection Program, is not going to make one single bit of difference. I pointed out to them before, and this is a fact, they can't get around to trying to dispute it, is even if you wiped out all of Oregon's CO2 emissions, and it's calculated out to be like 68 million metric tons per year, if you wiped all of that out, it's only 0.18%. That's 0.18% of global emissions. It wouldn't even make a dent in the atmospheric CO2 level. And same thing nationally. If they wiped them out nationally, which would be committing a human genocide, it's that severe, that's only wiping out 12% of emissions. It tells you there's something seriously wrong, Mark, with the climate modeling that they've done that has the sensitivity of temperature to CO2 way out of whack. And these guys don't want to admit it. They've had 30 years of running these things to know that they're not working, and we've had other people, other scientists in the fringes telling them this, and they refuse to change their ways. And I think the reason is it's the corruption of public money that's driving this. Yes. At the university level and everywhere else. So it's still not dead. I'm not sure, you're going to have to change political parties, I think, to completely kill it in Oregon. And that's
yes.
goes back full circle to the election thing we just talked about.
Yeah. Well, and I absolutely think that you're right, is that here in Oregon, they're going to do everything they can to keep that climate change money alive. Kotech just released a study that showed that at least $15 billion is not coming to Oregon because Democrats don't want the strings that Trump attached to that funding, meaning no more pushing of woke leftist ideologies. But they're digging in their heels. I think you're very correct, though, that they are going to try to use ODOT to raise taxes and then use ODOT to fund climate change and all the rest. I don't think we're seeing any panic just yet in those green circles, because some of those organizations got millions or even $1 billion. And I'm pretty sure I could make $1 billion last for 4 years waiting for Democrats to get back into power and start up my funding again. A constant stream of taxpayer monies every 4 years. That's the real renewable in renewable energy.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what I think they're doing at the local level, or trying to do anyway. Now, we'll have to see whether they actually pass anything. But in my opinion, and like I said, I hope the Judicial Watch lawsuit wins and they make significant ground with it. But I'm not going to be happy with any result of of these lawsuits until we reach the ultimate goal, which was in our lawsuit, that we get rid of vote by mail. You have got to go back and get security in voting back to where it has to be done the way it used to be before they went to vote by mail in this state in 1980. And that's that you had to go to a precinct that you're assigned to. You had to show identification that proves your citizenship and who you are to the person that's going to give you a ballot. You had to vote it at the precinct and turn it in at the precinct. It's counted at the precinct level all across these precincts in the state of Oregon. Then those results are turned into the county that they're in. The county tabulates the votes and then turns them into the state. That's always how it was done. It was secure, and it got rid of all these problems that we now see with vote by mail, with a lack of security. And the excuse used by the left today has always been, well, no, we've got to have vote by mail because every vote counts, and we've got to make it as easily accessible to the public to vote as possible. And they do this at the expense of security. That's the problem. And it's getting worse every time they pass these new laws, allowing ballots to be counted past the election day and all of the things that we've already talked about. So I'll be happy when we go back to that. We've got to have paper ballots, get rid of the machines, and have the tabulations done exactly like they were before 1980. If we can do that, and there's nothing wrong with it, and it's a bogus argument to say that, well, you're being too hard on people that can't have access to A, B, or C. There's all kinds of things, if you have a handicap, you can do to allow a provisional ballot to be made.
Yes.
That was always the case before 1980, and it can be again. So the excuses are lame, that we need to have a continuation of vote by mail just to make it convenient, to make sure every vote's counted.
And what is so wrong with making sure that the people that do vote actually have that right to vote and that they are who they say they are? You would think that that would make sense to people, but I'm not a Democrat, so I can't swear for that. Unfortunately, yeah. Chuck, we are up against the clock. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, I'm glad to be on, Mark, and let's hope the Judicial Watch lawsuit succeeds. Maybe we'll go somewhere with that. I'll keep my fingers crossed.
You know, it's easy to say there's no election fraud when you don't allow people to look. Where else in life do we do that? My bank account does not have nearly the amount of money it ought to. Kind of wonder if there's some sort of bank fraud happening. But your bank says, oh, there's no bank fraud going on. Pfft, trust us. Imagine trying to tell the IRS they can't look at your tax deductions and they just have to trust you. The same government that demands you prove yourself to be trustworthy for some reason doesn't want to prove its own trustworthiness when it comes to elections. An awful lot of society depends on trust. Public officials who don't want people to look and don't want people asking questions and fighting them when they do ask questions, well, they should no longer be public officials. And that's up to us. You wouldn't keep untrustworthy employees around. It's time to fire untrustworthy elected officials who appoint untrustworthy people to head untrustworthy agencies. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.